Today on Packet Pushers, we talk to network architect Andrey Koymyakov, who's helped his organization make the transition from traditional to open networking in production. So what's it like to disaggregate switch hardware from network operating system? Was it hard? Does it really work? And what's support like? Was any money saved? Will I get fired for suggesting my company go to the open networking route? Andrey will answer these questions and more. And Pete Lumbus, longtime friend of the Packet Pushers and contributor to the networking community, also joins with some of his insights learned in his role at Cumulus Networks. And just so we're all clear, Cumulus is a sponsor, but this is not a sponsored show. We just wanted to share the real-world experience of going new-school disaggregation with your networking. So Andrey and Pete, welcome to Packet Pushers. And Andrey, starting with you, I want to help frame the discussion here by understanding some terminology. So we say open networking, but we also say white box and disaggregation. So for our discussion today, does that all mean the same thing, or do you think we should make some distinctions?
Well, hello, everyone. So to that question, it does, to me, mean sometimes the same thing, but other times it means different things. It really depends on the context for me. When I say disaggregation, I explicitly refer to running an operating system that I did not purchase from the same place as I purchased my physical box from the same vendor, if you will, right? I could probably purchase them from the same VAR, but not necessarily traditionally like we would buy an operating system from Cisco on top of a Cisco switch. White box to me is a strange word. Originally, it started referring to merchant silicon, but then we all know that Cisco, Arista, Juniper all kind of have products with merchant silicon as well. So sometimes I use the word white box to mean not Cisco, Juniper, and Arista.
That's pretty common, and, though. That's not new in the sense that a lot of people would say, if not my existing vendor, it must be white box. Is you know, not unrealistic.
Right. And when I just started reading about this a couple of years ago, there was also a term called bright box, which was white box branded, right? So like with that in mind, is Dell a white box or bright box, right? And I would argue that Dell is a bright box, but who knows? So I guess for me, white box is just not three major network players, right? So Juniper, Cisco, and Arista.
Pete, did you have any color to add to that?
Yeah, I think open networking to me and what I see in the industry is kind of saying, like, is Red Hat open source? You know, like there is open source, there is open networking, there is Red Hat, there are commercial vendors. They are kind of sort of the same, but it's a lot more of an idea and a mindset from a white box and disaggregation. White box, I think Andrey hit it, you know, right on the head. But the other thing that is, every switch that you can buy has a brand associated with it. I think there is a level of, like, if you're Google, white box means, you know, I'm customizing something and having somebody built to spec. But it is creating this Gartner level contrast where Dell and HP and Mellanox want to say, look, it is commodity, but it's like special, shiny commodity.
We're also encouraging them to innovate as well. So Mellanox is substantially different from, you know, Pika 8. Pika 8, for example, is the same sort of thing. They're using generic hardware and putting their own operating system on top. We've got lots of other, you know, Big Switch is putting their own software on top of quite a wide range of hardware platforms. And what it means is that, you know, if you really want 100 gig at very low latency, then maybe Mellanox is the right product for you. But if you're just looking for a lot of 100 gig ports, then maybe a Dell or an Edge Core or something like that is the right switch for you. It just, and you get to choose, but you also get to choose the operating system separately from the hardware. I think that's the real issue here.
And that's, I think, what we want to focus on today is that disaggregation where you get to make those two different choices. So Andrey, you work for a sizable healthcare organization. Why? Why move to a disaggregated network hardware software model when you have this, you know, big company that's, well, potentially they could look at such a thing as a risk? What were the drivers for you?
Well, there were many, but it is somewhat of a funny story, right? It's the way kind of the cards fell. So when we started down this path, we actually had a real physical problem that we needed to solve. And it wasn't our management network. Some folks maybe call it out-of-band network, which was at the time based on a bunch of Juniper EX2100, I believe, or something like that. I don't remember the model, but basically very cheap switch. Unfortunately, it was a single power supply, and the rails were just complete garbage to the point that we had to design our own custom rail so we can get the switch out of the rack when we needed to replace it. Otherwise, if you put that switch in, it would be forever blocked by the PDUs in the rack, and you can never get it out. So we actually started down the path of trying to solve the redundant power supply problem and the rails problem, and then looked at other vendors, what is out there. Turns out no one has figured out the rails, believe it or not, except Dell. And then Dell had a cheap switch, which is, what is it, 3048, Dell S3048. And that happened to be one of the open networking switches, you know, so-called white box, where you could buy that without the operating system.
Yeah, you could have bought it bundled with Dell, you know, top to bottom. But right, it's an open platform, and so now you have choices.
That's exactly on point, right? So they will happily take your money and sell you, you know, Dell OS 9 and OS 10 and what have you. But since it's an open platform, now there was a somewhat shortish list of operating systems that I could run on it, and Cumulus Linux was listed as one of them, right? There were a few others, I think, but Cumulus Linux was one of them. And that's kind of started me down the whole rabbit hole of, well, if I buy the switch and I can run all these operating systems on it, let me go read about these operating systems and what they do and how they work and how they're licensed. And then going down that rabbit hole, kind of to cut the whole long story short, Cumulus Linux and Dell were right smack in the middle of all the hardware compatibility lists, right? Like the Cumulus supports the most switches that are out there that we you know, adorably call white box. And the most white box switches list Cumulus as a supported OS, right? So that kind of gives you the lowest risk of going down that path, Cumulus plus Dell. That's kind of how we ended up there.
So it started out just as a physical form factor problem. You found a switch that solved that issue, got curious because it was open, found Cumulus sitting in the kind of in the middle of the Venn diagram of platforms that could run it. And so you began with the out-of-band network. And is that what you've got now, just the out-of-band network, or have you actually pushed Cumulus further than that?
Oh, we did push Cumulus further than that. I want to say that we probably have more switches running Cumulus today than we have Cisco switches, or I guess we should count ports, right? So we use, where we do use Cisco, we use FEX, which is not a real switch, as we all know, right? So we might,
right, the fabric
we
extenders,
might as well
right.
count ports. Yeah. Right, right. So we do have quite a few Cumulus switches running today in production, actually passing customer packets.
Now, it's funny you call it a Cumulus switch, that we've switched to that, because it actually isn't. It's a Dell switch running Cumulus Linux.
That's true. That's right. True. But we refer to it as Cumulus switch.
Interesting.
Okay. But I wanted to kind of elaborate a bit on that question of why that software model, right? Another problem we were trying to solve at the time, it was not kind of front and center, but it was always in the back of our minds, is standardization and automation. Right, automation is all the rage today in the networking community. And Cisco famously was not quite automatable, right? Like if you consider screen scraping automation, then maybe, but it was actually quite hard. So seeing Cumulus Linux as being Linux, and we at Athena Health, we are actually a big puppet shop on the server side. So it's like, well, this is Linux, and we know how to automate Linux. So why don't we drop a puppet agent on it? And there you go, you have your automation, right? And we have expertise in-house that knows how to operate Puppet. The irony of that, we ended up not using that. We ended up learning Puppet ourselves on the network team. But that was the thinking at the time, yeah. Right? The proverbial unicorn, you know, pipe dream.
Can I just jump in for a second? A lot of people, I just want to jump in something. Most people in networking would be talking about Ansible, but you're talking about Puppet. And I think it's important to flag the difference here. Ansible is an agentless. That is, you can use Ansible to scrape CLIs, to scrape APIs, to scrape SNMP, but you don't need to put anything on the switch. And that means you can make it work with your legacy. You're talking about Puppet, and Puppet needs an agent on the switch. So the Puppet server talks to the Puppet agent on the switch, and then the software agent, or the Puppet agent, does the things for you. And there's a fundamental difference here between the way Ansible works and the way Puppet works at a strategic level. So you needed Linux to be able to have a Puppet agent. That was a mandatory requirement. Is that right?
It wasn't quite a mandatory requirement. We could have gone with Ansible, right? Like what I was mentioning is that there was not a problem front and center, but Cumulus Linux being Linux just kind of happened to open that door. And then we went through the whole kind of decision tree. Well, we now have an option of running Ansible or Puppet. And I would argue that when we started, which was now more than 2 years ago, Puppet was a more mature platform, right? Ansible, I think, matured quite a bit in the past year or two. So if I am to have the discussion today, perhaps Ansible would have won that battle. And we also have discovered over the past 2 years that Puppet is just not a good tool for certain jobs, just like Ansible is not a good tool for certain jobs. They have their strengths and weaknesses, right? And I find my personal opinion is that having an agent on the box continuously enforcing a state is more advantageous than having a control host in an agentless fashion reach out to a fleet of switches and kind of enforcing that state, right?
So on the other hand, I've got to have an agent. You wouldn't be able to orchestrate any of your legacy stuff with Puppet. You've got very limited choices when it comes to orchestrating. Like if you had some brownfield and you had some legacy stuff, you wouldn't be able to do a whole lot with that.
You're absolutely correct. Yes, and if you are going, you know, if your goal is to automate your brownfield without replacing anything, then perhaps Ansible is a better option. And the community is big now and developed, and more plugins and libraries show up there, right? But that was not our use case. And at the time, we saw a bigger advantage with going with Puppet and perhaps using the same data structures. In fact, we have learned that even though both Ansible and Puppet use YAML as a backend kind of data structure, if you will, right? Could use JSON or YAML, but we use YAML. The data structures are sufficiently different that Ansible and Puppet can't really reuse each other's data easily.
Yeah. This is what I was just reflecting on the fact that sometimes with open, there's so many choices, you can get a bit lost. So I just wanted to explain the difference between the two, because mostly we only talk about Ansible in networking because most of the people in networking are actually who are using Ansible are all running legacy infrastructures. So that was their first. They didn't start from what you've done, which is saying I could start with Puppet. Anyway, I just wanted to flag
that. Right. And for us, basically, the reason we kind of saw advantage in this disaggregated model is that since the most time you spend, right, your biggest lock-in, if you will, is developing the tooling, right? This is the biggest investment is developing that tooling, right? If I can develop my tooling against an operating system, which is in this case, right, Cumulus Linux, and I have this flexibility of swapping out hardware underneath without redeveloping my tooling every time I swap out the hardware, to me, that was a big advantage, right? So we have a good relationship with Dell. We have a good relationship with Cumulus, right? But if I don't like Dell tomorrow, it's really, really easy for me right now to turn around and go and buy EdgeCore or Penguin or something else without actually almost doing no changes to my tooling.
And I think that, to me, the whole disaggregation model, that's the power, is how do I run my business? And Andre and I have talked about this before. You know, he found out that Dell has these rails that snap on. They can rack and stack a switch in a couple of minutes. You know, that has nothing to do with the software, but that's the hardware decision point for them. And when we've talked about, you know, what about potentially other partners, Andre's first question to me is, do they have speed rails? Because if they don't, then I don't care. And it's such a like simple little thing, but it totally changes how they do data center ops. And so that ability to have the thing that matters to your business and go, oh, that's the thing that's going to make us more money as a company, let's buy that one.
Was the choice of Dell, did it really just come down to that physical rail issue, Andre? Or were there other things that, as you were looking at the different white box platforms that were out there, you used other decision points in addition to just those rails to decide, Dell, that's the box I'm going with?
It sounds funny today, but yes, it really was. It really came down to rails and the fact that we were already buying Dell servers, right? So we had a good relationship with Dell. We already spending a lot of money with them. So this kind of felt like, well, we just can always tack it onto the PO. And it kind of gives us more negotiation power that way as well, right? But that's, if you start thinking, it was like, well, if I have now set up a new vendor, I have to go through the vendor procurement vetting process, all the contracts and everything. It was just, in some ways, easier to go with Dell.
Talking
to people on the ground, after they saw Dell rails on the switch, they're like, wait, what? I can have a switch out of the box in under 5 minutes racked and powered up, and I don't need a screwdriver and any tools whatsoever, just two of my hands. Like, that was a win for people on the ground. And if you know,
so much for Craig's networking.
Craig, I'm sure, knows how enterprises work, right? Like, you, it's always hurry up and wait, right? It's like, we're going to have this project, and then everyone's sitting in their hands for like 2 months, and then eventually someone says go, and everyone places the POs, and everyone is behind immediately, right? So if I can spend a day racking switches in my whole data center, right? Let's say, I don't know, 50 racks or something like that, as opposed to 2 weeks. Right, that it would take me with, you know, taking a little screw out of the little baggie and finding a screwdriver and screwing that in, and then it probably falls through the perforated tiles, and then you're like, what the hell now? So if I can rack all of my switches, you know, in half a day,
surprising that after 30 years of data centers, we've never thought of this before.
Oh, it's
that was the bane of my existence, and still is. Like, when I was racking switches myself, I hated those things. And Cisco, in their infinite wisdom, decided to make screws that you could not get anywhere else except from Cisco.
I have this blood in a few data centers that I've worked in trying to install cage nuts, stuff like that. Oh, it's crazy. Okay, so everything was really aligned with Dell for you. You were already a Dell customer. You already had that purchase relationship. They made a switch that was physically very attractive just to be able to rack that thing so easily.
And it was price competitive, another important part, right?
Port density and speeds and feeds are things that would have been a part of that decision. I take it, as you looked around, that just, you know, everybody makes about the same thing, and so that wasn't a big concern?
Well, that's another point, right? So we were looking at the time for a management switch. So I needed, you know, 48 ports of 1 gig capable switch, and I didn't want to pay, you know, multiple thousands of dollars for it. So that's a competitively priced switch, right? Like, go find your pricing kind of thing, right? But you will find that that particular switch is very aggressively priced, especially without an operating system. So all of a sudden, I have hot swappable redundant power supplies, hot swappable fan trays, right? Speed rails. I have 48 ports of 1 gig and 10 gig uplinks. And I can run arbitrary, well, air quotes, arbitrary operating systems on top of it, right? All that for very little money. So I think that kind of solidified the decision. And that's how we got introduced into the whole open networking.
Yeah. Once you made that decision, now you've got switches that are not out of band management only. They're actually pushing production traffic. And I'm guessing you've got 10 gig or maybe 25, 50, 100. What other kind of switches did you get into as you went into production?
Right. So eventually it becomes a chain, right? So since we had Dell and the out of band, those 1 gig switches, well, Dell also sells effectively on the same rails, 10 gig switches, right? Dell 4048, which is Broadcom Trident 2 chipset, right? Mm-hmm. So that's 48 port of 10 gig, 640 gig uplinks. If you go look through Cisco's portfolio or Juniper's portfolio, they have identical form factor and identical port count, right? So you're coming down to comparing prices at this point, and advantages that you get beyond, you know, speeds and feeds.
Yep.
And then that also opened the doors into, well, let's not look at leaf and spine. Oh, what can we get for spine switch? Well, Dell also sells 6000 or 6010, which also Trident 2 and Trident 2 Plus platforms with 32 ports of 40 gig, right? And just like everyone else on the market, everyone sells the same form factor with the same number of ports, with the same speeds. So that, again, becomes a decision.
These are all fixed config switches you're buying, then? You're not buying any chassis with line cards?
We're trying to stay away from chassis, to be quite honest. I think everyone in my team had their fair share of pain with chassis that we kind of don't want to deal with them anymore.
Yeah, pain and expense and proprietary and crossbar fabrics and, yeah, all the things, right? Well, okay, what was the purchase process like when you're buying? We're talking about Dell, so okay, do you buy it bundled with Cumulus, or do they just ship you hardware and then you get a Cumulus license and load it on to the switch yourself?
To my knowledge, Cumulus kind of, and Pete can confirm or deny that, but to my knowledge, Cumulus walked away from selling licenses directly, and I imagine there's some bureaucratic reasons or whatnot. So we actually buy our licenses from a reseller. We started with Dell. Dell will happily sell you Cumulus license we now buy them from someone else, and we buy switches directly from Dell because we can. But also, I can buy my Dell switch from the same reseller I buy my Cumulus license today from.
So does the switch really show like, up with no OS on it, and you actually fire it up, you're presented with Oni, and then you load Cumulus, or?
Yes, the switch shows up without an OS. In fact, we got a couple Dell switches the other day that showed up with OS 9. That was not a nice process, because now you have to hook in the console and erase the switch and this kind of thing, right? So we almost kind of rely on the fact that the switch shows up with no OS and boots into Oni.
Oni, for if you're listening and not familiar with that, open networking installation environment. It's basically a very small footprint bootloader that gives you the opportunity to point the switch at an operating system sitting out on the network and load it up. And I'm assuming that you guys have a server or something with a Cumulus sitting on it. You can point the switch at it or point Oni at it, and off you go.
Right. So Oni, like if you know Pixie Boot, that's what Oni is. It just runs on the switch, right? It's I'm sure some would argue Oni is a better Pixie or something like that. But basically, when the switch comes up, it will Oni will enable the management interface on the switch, right? And it will look for a DHCP offer on that interface. And in the DHCP offer, you can give it through DHCP options a location of the operating system to install. It doesn't have to be Cumulus. You just needed to give a URL of the installer, right? Then when, in the case of Cumulus, when the Cumulus installs, it follows kind of the same process. Cumulus call it ZTP, zero touch provisioning, but it's the same idea. It will look for options in the DHCP offer. And you can give it through an option path to a Cumulus, to a script that will do the rest of the things, right? Like install the license, put some base config, or tell it's like go ask Puppet or something like that for the rest of your configuration, but that basic bootstrap, right? So you can feed it everything to DHCP options.
I was just going to say, to go back to some of that acquisition thing, you know, I think Andre described one way through Dell. I think every white box vendor, including Cumulus, has come across a bunch of customers that go, okay, but that's not how we do it today. And we go, well, okay, that's a new way of doing things. They're like, yeah, but that's really scary. We're real big fans of new stuff. And so I think every white box vendor now has some sort of turnkey solution. I know Cumulus calls theirs Cumulus Express, where it's an edge core switch with Cumulus and a license. Peak 8 started making their own hardware, so you can buy a Peak 8 switch with their software and license preloaded on it. But there's like a whole gamut of like, I just want to buy a bare metal switch with nothing on it. I want to buy it pre-installed with my OS and license, or anywhere in between. I think, again, this kind of comes back to like, how do you want to manage how you run that network and do that operation stuff? And there's a choice somewhere in there from every one of the white box vendors for it.
Yeah, making easier to consume the solution, not having to change up the operational process or learn too many new skills to be able to fire that thing up.
Let me throw a benefit into this, right? So of course you can buy it that way, the way that Pete described, right? But another benefit we saw in this, kind of tying this whole ZTP and acquisition process together, we also use Big Switch monitoring fabric for our kind of monitoring, you know, munging packets kind of thing solution. Well, mm-hmm. Guess what? It runs on the same switches, literally identical hardware, right? So yep. When my switch shows up with an OS, I can basically yank it out of the pile and say, well, today I need another BMF, switch running BMF. And I just feed it a different image,
yep.
Right? So to me, it's advantageous that the switch shows up without an OS.
Yeah, you've just unified your operational process. You don't have to buy different hardware switch platforms, and loading it is just a choice of whichever OS you need, right? That's really interesting that you're also running Big Monitoring Fabric. If you've listened to Packet Pusher's audience, you've heard us talk about that over the years. That's really interesting.
Andre, do you guys keep cold spares, or do you still do like 4-hour RMA, or did that process change for you since it's the same hardware for both?
We keep cold spares because it literally is, over the long run, cheaper to shelf spare than to actually pay replacement cost, right? So especially on the cheap switches, 1 gig switches, it is cheaper for me to buy a few extras and keep them on the shelf than to keep paying year over year replacement cost. And then, as with any enterprise planning in my career, it went, you always have those one-time, like one-off, oh, I need this switch now, today, here, and then you go to Dell or Cisco, you know, literally ask any of your vendors, right? How long will it take them to drop a switch off at your loading dock?
It'll take us 3 weeks to get a quote, and then it'll take us 3 weeks to process your purchase order, and then it'll be out of stock for 8 weeks. And yeah,
exactly. Sorry. Yeah. So we, I think you're saying everything that we're all thinking.
Ching ching again.
It is actually enabling us to move much quicker for the business to just have shelf spares.
Yeah. Not surprised at all about that.
SFP modules have, I want to ask a question about SFP modules, because this is a really hot topic right now. Is you're using, you know, a switch. Are you using generic SFP modules? And have you had any problems with buying SFP modules to go in those switches?
We did and we did not. So for the longest time, we have been working with a very trusted vendor of ours who will sell us third-party SFPs. Mm. And, you know, reach out to me on the side. I can give you the name. I will. I've been kind of promoting them on the side there. But anyway, so we have been working with them, and they've been selling us, I would say, you know, quality product, so to speak, that will work in Cisco and Juniper and Arista and whatever. They will provision it for you.
Right.
And they just keep doing this for us for the Dell switches. Now, with that said, Cumulus cares a lot less for the authenticity of the SFP. Mm-hmm. They still have what they effectively list as supported, but they don't explicitly non-support anything, right? Like, they don't forbid you from using anything else. So we buy SFPs and QSFPs from the same vendor. They do code them for Dell, but we have since inserted Cisco coded SFPs and QSFPs and Arista coded ones and Juniper coded ones. And then in some cases, even, you know, Dell coded ones went into Cisco boxes and this kind of thing. So they all kind of becoming interchangeable. So we only had one.
Looking forward to more widespread use of home programming. So when you'll be able to have your own programmer and you'll be able to take the SFP and put it into a box and say, this one's going to be on this brand, this one's going to be on this brand. And it just loads the code, you know, the right code for the right box, and boom, you're in business. You don't have to.
We have toyed with that idea. We just have not arrived to that yet. But we had only one problem where we bought a batch of QSFPs, and I think the manufacturer decided to load new firmware on them, like that little board inside a QSFP. I guess they decided to upgrade hardware and load the firmware or something like that. And that crashed the switching plane on the switch when you insert it, right? And then our vendor worked with us basically to RMA all of that. I don't know how big the loss they took, right? But we RMA 300 QSFPs. You can kind of estimate your prices right there.
Yep.
And they sent us something that worked with us. And they actually, they went bought a Dell switch. They went licensed Cumulus. Right. And then they found the QSFPs in their lab that they would work with us. And then when they shipped it to us, it worked. Right. So that kind of gives you that idea, is that if you have a good relationship with your vendor, they will test it for you. Right. Like, you don't have to test it in production.
That's the advantage. You can go and buy the cheapest ones online, and that's what, you know, where you're not paying enough money for them to care about you. But if you take a step up, there's profit margin in them for the company to take your call. And just to make a note here, when you're returning 300 SFPs, it's really easy to get that done, because the return cost isn't about how many you're sending back. It's the cost of the transaction to return them. So the cost of taking them back into stock, packaging them up, sending them back to the vendor for replacement and getting the refund, that's the cost. Whether it's 10 SFPs or 300 actually isn't all that relevant. The cost is in the transaction, not the number of things being returned.
Well, it's interesting you mention it that way, right? In our case, what happened is that we got a box of 300 QSFPs, right? Mm. So they run you $500 an op a piece. Mm. And we already inserted them into every switch.
Ah, okay, right. Yes, so they were used.
So now you have to go track down which of them is actually crashing your switch. So we actually had to write automation to go look for the logs and track down which switches are affected. Then go tell the data center people on the ground, say, go into this switch and pull this QSFP, and then we have to schedule the reload of that switch because now the data plane is not functioning. And then you have to track them down by serial number, you could write
a script to do that.
Yes, we did that and it worked, but it was painful. So like that, it wasn't the cost of the shipping label. It was a lot of man hours going, finding all that. And
painful, but possible. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You didn't have to spend 6 months on the phone to a support line arguing, until they finally accepted that it was their responsibility, and you've got boxes rebooting every other day and everybody looks stupid. Yeah.
And to kind of to go to the original question, that is the only problem with SFPs and QSFPs we had with Dell running Cumulus. And both parties involved here, which was Cumulus and our QSFP vendor, they were just real troopers in this, right? Like Cumulus tech is just fantastic. It's probably the most knowledgeable people I've ever worked with. And then our QSFP vendor was on the phone with us every day. You know, how is it going? What can we do? Do you want us to ship you a different part number so you can test or whatever, right? So everyone was just on top of it. So I have, I don't have enough words to say good things about it, right? Like that experience was great. As painful as it was great.
So, Andre, you mentioned that you're running a couple of different operating systems. You've got Cumulus Linux, you've got Big Switch Networks, Big Monitoring Fabric. Well, how open is open here? I mean, could you run anything you want? There's a whole lot of different entrants in the network operating system world. So how flexible is this platform and this ecosystem, really?
That's an interesting question. I think from the enterprise perspective, I don't actually want to be able to run anything I want, right? Do we really think that in the enterprise we have engineers with enough clue to go program the ASIC? Right? Like who's gonna staff that? I have a hard time hiring engineers that understand basic routing. Right, so like understanding ASIC is super hard. I've learned more about ASICs than I cared to learn in the past year or two. Right, we're dealing with white box. So if you're looking to learn, going white box definitely will open your eyes to how some hardware works and what's happening and the difference between chips and everything. You know, in my career when I was buying Cisco, I never had to understand how chips work. Right, basically Cisco comes and tells me, like, yes, this moves packet from A to B, and you do these commands.
I had to know the internal guts of things like ACE modules and 6500. I knew what chip was on what line card and what that chip was capable. You have to at some point when you get down to a level of operational excellence. I can't see how you can't end up at that.
Right. So as you grow, right, it becomes interesting. But as you just enter that kind of, you know, network engineering force.
All right. Like, sorry. Yes.
What is just the minimum amount of commands I can run for this to start working so I can go pat myself
on the back and tell John,
the boss that I'm done?
Hi, my name's John. I'm really good at configuring VLANs. So, John, you see the ASIC?
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to program the ASIC. Eventually, I want it to just move packets for me, right? Because at the end of the day, what we do is we need to provide some kind of IP connectivity to a bunch of hosts connected on the end. I'm sure it's in 90% of cases that that's the goal, right? If you need something specific, then it's a whole different business case there. But in this case, you know, we use today Big Switch Monitoring Fabric. We use Cumulus Linux. Are we always toying with the idea of using Big Switch Cloud Fabric, right, which runs on the same hardware? For me, it's just changing DHCP option, right? If I have a business case that I need to, if I have a problem that I can solve with this product, right? But I can go to Dell and get their Dell OS 10, which is actually free. You just don't get anything with it.
Because they license the apps on top of OS 10.
Right, right. And then you can put on top of it what you want. You can put BGP daemon, you can put SNMP daemon, you can put like whatever you want. What I don't know about OS X is that how the ASIC is licensed. So like Broadcom famously wants a license for their work, right? Mm. So like with Cumulus, they ship you SwitchD, which is, you know, Pete, keep me honest here, but SwitchD is the only non-open source part of Cumulus Linux. Mm. And effectively, what you're paying for in licensing is for ASIC license.
Mm. Or paying Broadcom's license fee, yeah.
Exactly, right. So if you want to go to Broadcom, if you're Facebook or Google, if you want to go to Broadcom and license that SDK directly, you can. Would you want to? Probably not.
Yeah.
As a general enterprise, right? So that's kind of like, it can be as open as you want. It's just a matter of how much clue you have and how much time you want to spend on actually configuring your switch.
Well, then take us through some gotchas then, Andre, because it sounds like you mentioned a couple of things there. It sounds like there's potentially some licensing concerns. There are some differences between chipsets that are installed in each of these white box hardware platforms, and that you had to pick up on some of those along the way. So take us through some of these gotchas that people shopping white box should be looking out for.
Right. So this was not important in our out-of-band network, right? It was basic VLANs, the way you've always been doing networking, put all your ports on the switch in the same VLAN or different VLANs, whatever, you know, in the Cisco world, it would be like switch port, what is it, access VLAN 500 or something like that, right? But as you start putting production traffic on it, I like to call it, you know, revenue generating ports. you want to start to understand kind of how the chipsets work. And all the rage right now is, you know, VXLAN and EVPN and those kind of technologies. And you start needing to understand, well, Broadcom Trident 2 has VXLAN bridging, but cannot do VXLAN routing. Well, T2 Plus can do VXLAN routing. And then when we started, Cumulus did not have VXLAN routing support in software. Now they do, right? Yeah. And then now we've discovered that there is a quirk in T2 Plus. Even though it can do VXLAN routing, it can't always do it the way you want it to, right? So you have to have these ugly workarounds. So now we're kind of waiting for, you know, T3. And then you go and look, it's like, well, Mellanox can do this without having the workaround. So you start looking into how different chips offer you different solutions to the same problem, right?
But you've got the same problem with those problems exist in every platform. So if you've got a Nexus 9000 and you've got an early gen, you can't do VXLAN routing on those. Like what I'm saying is you can't de-encapsulate a VXLAN packet at layer 2 and then route it at layer 3. You have to wait for the ASIC functions to happen. That's not different for your boxes than it is for any other box.
Right. That's correct. Right. And that's, I guess, that's that gray ground where you have to gray area where you have to understand what is the problem you're trying to solve and, you know, how you're going to solve it and when you need to solve it.
Everybody's got that problem. Arista, Juniper, whether they've got their own chips or someone else's chips, because all of them have these static pipelines and they might do like the current Trident 3 does three programming steps on the way in and two programming steps on the way out. Well, that's still only five programming steps. You're very limited into the sort of programmability that you get on these static ASICs, whereas this is where we've seen these new ASICs come out, which are fully programmable, but you sacrifice stuff. They're a little slower. They're more expensive because they're bigger, harder to make, and so forth and so on.
A little slower, not slow. I mean, the Fino's still sub-microsecond, but yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, a tiny bit. You know, you've got to be, you don't, it's not like using Tofino or Innovium, they come with a zero-sum game. There is a price to be paid. And yes, it is tiny in for real use cases. So, yeah.
Vendor lock-in. Now, you've talked about, hey, I can fire up the same piece of hardware, load up Oni, and just point it at the image I want to load. So it sounds like you don't really have vendor lock-in, at least from an operational perspective. Or do you? I mean, was avoiding a vendor lock-in... First of all, do you think vendor lock-in is actually a myth? Everybody's locked in one way or another. What's your whole take on that?
I think everyone is locked into something, right? Eventually. So here, in our case, I would argue that we are locked into Cumulus Linux, right?
It would have thought you were locked into Puppet.
Yeah.
Perhaps, but unlike Cumulus, Puppet is free, right? Obviously, you can give Puppet money and they will happily take it, right? But we use the free version. So you are locked into your tooling, more or less, right? And for us, tooling is attached to Cumulus Linux more than it is attached to, I guess, to the hardware. So before that, I would have been locked into Cisco for hardware and software, right? Imagine I would have written up my tooling against Cisco iOS or an XOS, right? And if my relationship with Cisco sours, and I have to, and I go to Arista and say, Arista, give me, you know, a competitive price so I can replace Cisco with Arista, right? Or build my next set of racks on Arista. Well, now I have to rewrite my tooling because my relationship with Cisco soured, right? Where right now I'm locked into Cumulus, but I'm not locked into Dell. And I would argue that it gives me at least negotiating power with Dell. Does it give me negotiating power with Cumulus? It does to some extent. It's not impossible for me to walk away from Cumulus. It's just harder, right? But now my hardware is not attached to my tooling.
And
so
I think that's,
I reduced my vendor lock-in. I did not eliminate it.
And I think that's huge, right? You lock in where there's value, right? Is there value in the software? Or is there value in that ASIC that everybody puts in the same switch? And I think even on the software side for you, you've already got Big Switch in there. you have that relationship, you know, that kind of, what is it? The sword of Damocles is always hanging over Cumulus. You know, if that software vendor fails to deliver, you don't have to go and rip out 200 switches to replace them. I mean, yeah, it's an operational challenge, but it's not a physical one.
Exactly.
So was there anything?
Everything's a lock-in.
So was there anything?
You want to be locked into something. So it just, you know, you have to choose what you want to be locked into.
Yeah. And you want to pick something which is livable and suits you, you know, the people in your organization, the management, the finances, you know, the goals of the company. Is the goal of the company to save money at any price? Well, then you lock into an open source strategy and you get it for free and you spend extra hours making it go. Or do you go and buy it from a vendor? And then you save money by blaming them for everything so you can go home at 5 o'clock.
You just phrased that perfectly, locked into an open source strategy. You just, yeah. that nails it.
I even found that being locked into hardware is not useful, right? Like you're not going out to the market and says like, well, we run Cisco, therefore we're the coolest shop, right? Common, you know, type in conf-t every day. But if I go on the market and say, you can come and work for me and actually write code and learn new skills, right? It's far more interesting to kind of develop new skills. And for network engineers, I would argue it's writing code, right? It's not writing C code, right? It's scripting, but you're still writing code. You're learning new skills. You had a bunch of episodes on, you know, developing your a new, shall we call them, SRE skills or something like that. Eventually, we all start writing some kind of code. Right. So in our team, as a result of going to open networking, we have developed skills. We now understand, you know, how Git works. We now understand what merge requests are or pull requests are. Right. We understand what the hell YAML is. Before that, we did not even know what that was. Right. We understand how automation works and how to start thinking about that and how scripting works. Right. And how manage large fleets of equipment where before, if you needed to make change on 50 switches, guess what you were doing? You were logging in 50 times, right? So all these skills that are new, that are interesting, and I think if you're hiring engineers that will bring you value, they will want something interesting to work on and to grow their own skill sets. I don't think it's fair to say, well, you engineer, come and you deliver value, right? And I'm an employer, my obligation to you is to give you money. I don't think that's fair. That's not a good place to work for.
No, you know, for some people, it's a choice. I mean, you can go and buy your gear from, you know, vendor C or vendor J, pay their tech support costs, and if everybody's happy. And then as an engineer, you can just say, it doesn't work, I've raised a case with the tech, and then head out home. You know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spend, you know, half of my life at work, so I kind of want it to be also interesting.
I'm on your side, but I'm just pointing out the other side. If you don't want to take responsibility and you want an easy life, just, you know, waste your employer's money hand over fist and give it all to a brand. And, you know, there's definitely a case to be made.
To that point, I think finger pointing is a myth.
Yeah, I was curious about
not,
that.
Not if you ran into a single throat to choke is a myth.
Okay. Yeah. So then when you're supporting this solution that's got several different brands attached to it, you've got Dell, you've got Cumulus, then you've got whoever else you're interacting with. A puppet, perhaps. One throat to choke isn't necessary. In other words, you've resolved whatever issues you've had dealing with multiple providers.
We have, and yes, I will stand by that statement. A single throat to choke is not a thing. That's a myth. From my perspective, I think I already gave praise to Cumulus Tag, but those folks are just fantastic, super knowledgeable, right? So even if I don't know how to resolve this problem, they will point me in the right direction, right? They can say with certain degree of certainty that is likely a hardware problem, right? Go, you know, we can try and work with Broadcom in our case, right? And see if we can resolve this problem. Or
is it Broadcom or is it Dell?
It's a strange world where the box is made by Dell, but the ASIC is Broadcom, right? Mm-hmm. So if the problem is determined to be on the ASIC, it is eventually going to be a Broadcom's problem. And since Cumulus is what's running software on top of the Broadcom ASIC, if you will, right? It's kind of in their court to solve that problem for us. I'm not going to be going to Broadcom, right? I can go talk to Dell, but eventually Dell will say, well, this is about how Cumulus perhaps implemented this feature. So it's a Cumulus a responsibility to talk to Broadcom, right? But if it's, you know, a power supply failing on the box, of course it's a Dell problem, right? It's a yes or no switch, right? If Cumulus says, well, this power supply is not responding to me, then I go talk to Dell, like swap out this power supply and it works.
So the thing that some people are deathly afraid of is that no one's taking responsibility for the issue. They just keep pointing the finger one at another, and no one's owning the problem to bring it to a resolution. But you're saying you're kind of describing this. Well, Dell might say it's Broadcom, who might say it's the way the software was implemented on this chip, and you know, but yet you have been successful in getting all your issues resolved.
Yes, we have been successful and have not run into an instance where two third parties point fingers at each other. In fact, take that example of QSFP problem, right? When I was crashing the data plane, that was Cumulus working with OSI hardware, figuring out whose problem that was. I literally told them, call each other and figure it out. And they did, right? And that is, to me, that's responsible vendors providing real value to the customer. And I will give OSI more money because they do it for me, right? We have came across other vendors that will sell us, you know, same QSFP for less money. But we said, like, OSI gives me real value. They have proven that they're worth the that extra, you know, whatever, you know, 10% premium, whatever that number is, right? And they worked out with Cumulus what the problem was. Like, to me, that's real value. Was that finger pointing or was that collaboration, right? And then take, for example, and I'm not bashing on Cisco specifically, but I grew up on Cisco, so I'll use them as an example. Cisco is a complex organization, right? If you have your Cisco server connected to a Cisco Nexus switch and they can't negotiate speed on the port, whose problem is it? Yes, it is Cisco's, but show me someone who was not bounced around tech for a while on some complex issue.
Between the different business units.
Right. How is that not finger pointing?
Yeah.
And I can even talk to the problem Andre had. You know, that was the firmware on the optic being read by the I2C bus on the hardware, the Dell switching hardware, causing a lockup due to some incompatibility issues that I'm not smart enough to understand. But that was nothing that could be fixed in software. You know, that was a hardware implementation of the physical switch and a firmware implementation of the physical QSFP. Hmm. You know, and those things happen. And I think every white box vendor, you know, if you're not presenting yourself to the world as like, hey, we only sell to Google, so you figure it out yourself and write your own code, I think any white box vendor that's selling to enterprise has to be able to deliver on that end-to-end thing. And we at Cumulus, if it is a chip issue, you know, we will open a case with Broadcom and figure that out as a, you know, we are technically a Broadcom customer. And again, true of every other vendor running on Broadcom chips, they end up working directly with the Broadcom chip developers and SDK developers to find the issue, identify it, build a fix, get an updated SDK, and then get that back to that end customer.
It's interesting to hear that, yes, there are these sorts of issues, but it doesn't feel like it's so fragile and complicated to come up with a combination of hardware and software that are going to work together that it's like, oh gosh, I don't want that egg. It doesn't sound that bad at all. Yes, things can happen. Yes, you might have a support issue that pops up once in a while, like the optic issue we've discussed, but it doesn't sound like it's overly difficult to come up with a solution that's going to work.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, Andre, you've had one bad batch of QSFPs out of, you know, make up a number of how many batches of optics you've bought since you've been in production.
Yeah, absolutely. It just showed up one day, right? Like, we've been buying them for 2 years, and then the seller traced them down to a new revision of hardware for the board on the QSFP. We actually talked to OSI after that and said, well, what can we do to prevent this from happening in the future? Because this was quite painful, right? And one of the things they do is they run Cumulus on Dell switches and they test them. And actually, the other week, we needed to convert a QSFP port to an SFP port because reasons. And what I did is I called I called OSI and says, like, I have this corner case where I'm going to only need this four pieces of this of these adapters, right? I'm not going to buy them every day. I'm not going to buy hundreds of them. I just need four of them because this is like a very one-time off thing that I just need to solve this problem. And they went and said, well, we have them and we'll put them in a switch for you, test them out, make sure they work. And then if they work, we'll sell them to you, right? So I knew they're going to work in my hardware, in my software, in Cumulus running on Dell before I even cut the PO.
Andre, I want to ask you a couple of just operational questions, some practical things that might be bouncing through people's heads with this solution. We've got a pretty good understanding of the hardware, the software, how that works, how you get it supported, just the day-to-day operations, monitoring for one thing. Do you use a network monitoring system with SNMP to track these switches, or do you do something else?
We do both. We use SNMP because that's what we know and hate. I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
You did.
But yes, so you can still run your SNMPD, right? It's in case of Cumulus, it's Linux. So this is where you kind of have to start understanding what does what, right? Traditionally, we didn't have to. It was like, well, does Cisco support SNMP? Of course they do. But in this case, you have a Dell switch, but you're running Cumulus software on it. And what provides the SNMP functionality is Cumulus, right? So you have to check if the operating system you want to run supports the monitoring opportunities that you want to kind of exploit in this case. So since this since Cumulus Linux is Linux, as they like to say, it is, you just run SNMPD, you configure it the same way you would configure your server, right? Like if you monitor your Linux servers with SNMP, you monitor the switch running Cumulus the same way. It's just a Linux server with 50 interfaces.
Yeah.
So you have your, you know, OIDs for power supplies. You have to discover them, right? Like you have to realize what they are. So you have your OIDs for power supplies, for fans, for CPU utilization, memory utilization, disk utilization, you know, in-out errors, in-out bandwidth or utilization on every interface. So your usual NMS is most likely to be able to monitor your switch running Cumulus just fine with SNMP. The challenge we found is that, as it is with any new vendor, your NMS probably does not have the MIBS loaded, right? So you may have to kind of hunt for them, not hunt for the MIBS, but kind of teach your NMS to read the right OIDs on the box.
Yeah, if the NMS is really targeted at network devices, it may not be looking for a what is really a server-oriented SNMP daemon, and it may not be in there initially. And so, right, you got to what? Just compile the MIB into the NMS, and then off it goes at that point.
Well, most of them are standard, right? So like interfaces, in-out errors, and bandwidth, that's standard. So any NMS can do that. Out of the box, the NMS was able to monitor CPU utilization. I don't think memory was there, but monitor disk utilization. You know, who would have thought, you know, disk utilization on the switch. But sometimes it's useful, right? Like you don't want to fill up your disk with logs, for example. Something like that. So most of the things are being monitored by traditional SNMP NMS. But when we started investigating, it was like, well, why isn't memory monitored out of the box? Well, do we want to spend more time investigating why our NMS is not doing that? Or do we just look at other solutions? Well, guess what we do for the rest of our fleet of Linux boxes, Linux servers? We just use, what is it called? CollectD. And it just exports metrics to Grafana. So we actually the other day deployed CollectD to all of our fleet of Cumulus switches. Now we can export any metric we want, not just memory. We effectively implemented telemetry.
And by
having an advantage of the fact that Cumulus is Linux, so you can deploy whatever you want.
That theme keeps coming up again and again. It's interesting. Just the flexibility you have now to load whatever you want. And if you've got server tooling that works, there's a good chance you can make it work on your switch now as well. That is an advantage. That really gets my brain spinning up. All right, some other networking practical kind of stuff. Routing protocol, BGP, OSPF, anything unusual about connecting it back to the rest of the network, whether that was Cisco or whatever it might have been?
It's not unusual. You know, we kind of touched on that a little while ago, like what does open mean? So while Cumulus Linux ships with FRR now, right, which is a fork of Quagga, it used to ship with Quagga, now ships with FRR, you can run that, and they support that, and it's great. Like, don't get me wrong, that's what we're running, and it's fantastic. But if you really you know, hate Quagga. You can uninstall that and install Bird or write your own or whatever you want, right? Like you can write any code on top of Cumulus that you want to do whatever you want.
This is actually a really important thing to point out here, because you just made the distinction that Cumulus Linux is the OS. It sits on top of that hardware, but by itself, there's not routing daemons there. That's free range routing, FRR, that's sitting on top of that, that is offering you those things.
Exactly. Yeah. So to us, FRR actually worked well. One of the big reasons for that was that it's easy to automate. You actually just drop a text file into the right location and reload the process, right? And then you have updated your configuration. So it's super easy to automate. Even if you know nothing about automation, all you have to do is generate a text file and deliver it to the device. And second, I think Cumulus kind of pioneered that or contributed that to FRR project is BGP Unnumbered, where we went down the path of running Leaf and Spine and using BGP as a control plane to run that and to run actually EVPN address family on top of BGP. And if you know BGP, you know that BGP is explicit addressing, right? I have to define every neighbor explicitly with autonomous system and my IP and remote IP. With BGP Unnumbered, and that's fantastic for automation, what it does, it actually establishes a session on using IPv6 link local addresses. So I don't have to address interfaces that I have to run BGP on. And second part they did is that I can basically say the remote AS either equals mine or does not equal mine. Remote AS is external or internal, right? And those two parameters basically let my whole fabric establish BGP relationships without me ever needing to put IP addresses on anything or configure any explicit neighborships. So I basically deployed a bunch of BGP or peer groups.
Yeah.
And that's all I had to do. So we're using that if for no other reason but that, to not have to deal with explicit IP addressing of transit interfaces, which in Leaf and Spine are many.
Very many, yes. So this is interesting. This is not magical. This is, you know, people that are just so intimidated because it isn't the Juniper or the Arista or the Cisco that you're used to. You walked into this and just figured out what you needed to figure out. It wasn't hard. And off you go. You're running BGP in this unnumbered state for your Leaf Spine fabric.
Right. And then just we decided to take advantage of that feature, right? Like in Athena Health, we don't actually take advantage of another feature Cumulus has. It's their NCLU, Network Command something, Linux utility or something, which basically is kind of letting you, the traditional network engineer, type in commands such as, you know, IP, route, blah, blah, blah. So you would say, you know, net add route, and then you put a prefix and, you know, the next hop or something like that, or net add OSPF. And you can still configure the switch that way. It's just different syntax, but it's very familiar for people that have been doing this for years. If you want to do it this way, it's a little harder to automate, and we have not gone down that path. In fact, when we started with this, NCLU was not a thing. So you still had to, I think, do most of it is in text files. So Cumulus did a good job in, you know, kind of bringing those folks on board. But you can. We just don't use that.
It's just a way of solving objections. Customers are probably whining that there's no CLI. And I can see that there's a meeting room and there's all these people lined up and down one side of the table. There's a bunch of network engineers who say, you can take my command line interface out of my cold, dead hands. And on the other side of the table is, we need to have this so we can do it like in a grown-up, modern-facing way. In the middle of the manager's going, I can't sack them, but I want that. And so humans just build a pseudo-CLI for those people who aren't ready to make the move, I suspect.
No comment.
Don't have to answer that, Peter.
So, Andre, you've got a bunch of switches. They run Linux. You've got a bunch of servers. They run Linux. Did that change how your operations teams run, where maybe some of the server people can get involved in some of the network troubleshooting and maybe vice versa, now that the tooling and the base OS are roughly the same?
Excellent point. So we didn't quite touch on that, but we did have quite a few instances now where our server administrators log into the switch, and because they know the Linux commands, right? Like you don't have to use the Cumulus commands. You can use original Linux commands, right? IP link show and all that stuff, right? And if config, they in many cases can actually diagnose some problems before even calling the network guy, right? So if anything, we had fewer calls come in because of that, because our server administrators can go in and say, it's like, well, I see the MAC address or I see the IP address, or yeah, it does what it's supposed to do. So it must not be the network, right? That original premise, it's always the network unless proven otherwise, that's starting to break down a little bit.
Yeah, because it's no the network is no longer this represented by the cloud on the whiteboard because no one really knows what's going on in there. All of a sudden, you've got people who can actually log in with commands they're familiar with, see what's going on in there.
Right. Well, it's still the cloud on the whiteboard, right? But at least if they run LLDP, they can just like, well, I'm connected to this switch explicitly, and SSH into that name and see what's going on there, right? And because it's just a bunch of Linux interfaces, they already know how to deal with those.
But what about the NOC? Did anything change for them? Where I don't know what every shop's NOC is a little bit different, but typically they're doing triage. They're getting those inbound calls and trying to do initial troubleshooting of issues. Was their world any better or worse?
For us, it didn't really change a whole lot. We still show them that what we would call an SOP, standard operating procedure, right? So if you see this event, these are the steps you take, right? And if you see that event, these are the steps you take. And if you see something you don't recognize, then sure, call me, right? And then perhaps some of these steps, they can log in and do this. But for them, nothing changed. They were able to log into my Cisco hardware, my Juniper hardware, and do these steps. So for the NOC, nothing really changed. But I think like that advantage that we talked about a second ago, that is a little higher up the stack, right? Like that's not always a NOC job to go find out what the problem is.
Well, this has been the show that I was hoping it would be, where we could talk to someone who's running some flavor of an open networking stack in their production environment and then just kind of dig under the hood a little bit. What's that like? Was it really that hard? Not that hard? What changes? And we've got some pretty good insight into that. So I want to thank you both, Andre and Pete, for coming on and chatting with us today. Now, Andre, are you social? Do you have a Twitter account or a blog, anything like that you'd like to share?
I don't really socialize much. I do have a LinkedIn page. Not that I use it for any social activities. It feels obligatory now. I don't tweet or blog a whole lot. I put some blogs out on Packet Pusher's blogging space, kind of regarding that automation. They're getting quite dated now, and I'm starting to be more and more embarrassed about them. You know, if you have more questions, shoot me an email. I think that's going to be in the show notes, if I'm not mistaken, or, you know, ping me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to answer any more questions that you might have.
Sounds great. And thank you again for taking the time to be on the show today. And Pete Lumbus, same question to you.
All my writing ends up being of the vendor sort, so nothing interesting there. I'm on Twitter at PeteCCDE. And I think the last thing I'd plug is, I think every white box vendor out there has some sort of free version that you can play with, whether it's Cumulus, whether it's Big Switch. I think PK8 might even have something. Run it on your laptop. Give it a try.
All right. And that is it for the Packet Pushers weekly show today. You can find the show notes for this episode in your podcatcher. Just fire up your phone, look at the episode, and it's all going to be there. And if you visit packetpushers.net, you can discover over 1,000 other episodes from across our podcast network for networking and infrastructure professionals, along with our community blog and our news feeds. Tweet at Packet Pushers. You can follow us on LinkedIn, rate us on Apple Podcasts, and if you would, become a premium member at ignition.packetpushers.net, because we have even more great stuff up there at Ignition. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.